Next case on the calendar, let me call the case first. Next case is 99-934-99-1095, Mr. Williams versus Charles Williams, Mr. McKee.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court, this case is a very simple case about the proper application of the child support guidelines. In this case, all of the record is set forth in brief. I'm not sure that the Court has said through this. It's a simple matter of there's Mr. Charles Williams, who's on Social Security disability. He receives $670 a month. His minor daughter, who's in the custody of the other parent, receives $167 because of the Social Security disability. And there's been a real conflict among the districts as to how that child support goes into the calculation. We submit that the proper way to do it is to give him credit for everything that's paid, as is presently done in the 12th district. The money that's paid to the minor child is credited towards the joint obligation of Mr. Williams and his former wife. Mr. Williams is paid into the Social Security system in order to have gotten there. Yes.
Here's my right problem that both of you, I think, most in short amount of time, was referring to the brief. But the issue in the case is who gets credit. If we do it as the appellee one, where it goes into the figuring of the joint support,
right.
Doesn't that lessen overall the amount of child support the child gets?
Yes, it does, but the fact of the matter is there's a number of cases that speak to this in there. It doesn't lessen anything. Support that is being received through Social Security disability is there to replace what the obligor would have been paying.
Correct. If we credit your point with it, and then you do the formula, the child eventually gets more in support overall than if you put into a joint deposit by the The child always ends up with more under their version.
The reason is what goes on here is the child gets the money from Social Security. Then they put his money that he's receiving in from Social Security into a child support calculation. And he never gets full credit for the money that's being paid on behalf of the child. That comes from the joint support obligation of both parents. And what it makes it for is that there's always an obligation left over for the person who's receiving the Social Security that they got to pay. That's on top of that. And that may well be right in a number of cases where the obligor isn't stuck in a situation that he has additional income. That may actually be correct, but the cases that have been decided on this, a big part of the cases, and the cases from other jurisdictions in the ALR review that was cited in the materials, seem to indicate that the more proper way is to take put all of the money, not only the money that's coming into the obligor, the 670, but also the money going to the child into his income, the obligee has her income, and then when that money finally comes off, it comes off of what he is supposed to pay. And that way you end up with the child getting the full benefit of what the income resources are. Now, if there's SSI, which is sort of a government benefit, then there would be no child support owed because under the guidelines, SSI is not listed as income. Social Security disability can be counted as income, but it's counted as income, and it's there as income because of the fact that the obligor paid into the system. It's an insurance, and that's where why it's coming out. It's coming out because of his disability, and it's also coming out because of his paying into the system.
Did I hear you say that the income that's going to the daughter would the benefit that's going to the daughter would be show up as his income to him for purposes of deciding what the income each of the parties is?
Most of the cases that I've seen that really address that issue seem to say that's the better way because...
I didn't think that's what you were arguing. That's why I was interested that you said that. But
right. You
would agree that if the husband is to get, the father is to get the full credit for the amount going to the child, that that amount should be included in his income for purposes of terms of percentage.
Absolutely. I think that's the way to do it. The fact of the matter is this particular issue confuses most of the courts down in the 12th district. The judges, including Judge Flannery, who decided this case believes our 12th district is wrong, has presented to them that they were wrong and they rejected that particular opportunity to change. But the fact of the matter is, if he's going to get credit for what's being paid to the child, it has to go into the child support calculation at the very beginning.
Well, let me ask you, why do I need to have you explain to me and your opposing counsel, why does the child lose, why is the amount of the child diminished? I think you seem to agree that the amount of the child would be diminished under your formula. If you determine how much, doesn't the form require a computation first of how much it takes to support the child, how much should be, what amount of money the child should be used for the child, and then doesn't it mean that if your client gets this credit as you want, that there's a greater burden on the mother? But that doesn't work that way.
No, it does. What's going on here is that when you get to the joint support obligation, what happens under the way the 12th district and a number of the courts are applying it, when you get to the joint support obligation, the amount that's being paid to the child comes off of the joint support obligation, which means that the obligee gets the benefit of that money. And that money wouldn't have existed but for the obligor's work and disability. In other words, the mother in this case is getting the benefit of what the father is paying, and she's paying lesser of a share of her support obligation.
Well, but in determining how much the child should receive, that payment that she received directly is deducted, is it not? So then, in determining how much the party should be paying.
It's deducted, but it's deducted from both of their obligations instead
right.
of from his obligation. And that money only exists if it's going into the amount of money that he has earned, and the calculation should be based on it. It should be coming off on the other side based upon what his obligation is, not based upon what the joint obligation is. It's what the... I think what happens is there's confusion comes up because the child gets more money the other way. Well, the problem is that for the most part, this gentleman and a lot of people in this situation are receiving subsistence income, and that money that is paid to the child is there to replace what the father would have been paying had he not been disabled, and that's what that money is about. It shouldn't be coming off of both the obligor and the obligee's obligation to support this child.
The other version gives the other spouse, the non-disabled spouse, sort of a break.
Absolutely, it does.
Now, if you accept the other version as well, then your client would have to pay more to just the Social Security. He'd have to have the whole Social Security check to go to child, and then he'd have to pay some kind of loan disability payment to make the difference.
Absolutely, that's what's happening in this case. This gentleman, the only thing that he has coming in is this Social Security. And I'm advocating that whoever it is that their disability causes that money to be generated from, get the credit of it. If the mother had a situation that she was disabled and the child got that money because of that, I wouldn't advocate that money be credited towards either the joint obligation or the obligation of this particular parent. It should be credited on the basis of whoever the parent is who paid into the system and whoever has the disability on which that payment is being made from.
Considering it's replacing his income ability to pay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just advocate that the mechanics of the way that the courts do it throughout the state be changed to reflect that. There's a lot of interest in that throughout the state as to getting it straight because all of our courts, a number of our courts do it differently.
And the statute is not clear on that.
It absolutely isn't. It counts Social Security disability income as income, okay? It doesn't count SSI because SSI is a benefit that flows down from the government. You don't have to earn that. But Social Security disability is counted as income. It doesn't say about where the child's part comes in at. I think the better method, as I've looked through the cases, is to count it all, that the obligor is going to get the benefit of all of it. It should be counted in as all of it at the beginning. It should be taken off at the end as to what's being paid. In most cases, it'll probably end up with a zero amount, unless that particular obligor has income from other sources, stocks, bonds, businesses, whatever. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. Mr. Eagle.
Thank you, and please support counsel. It is a relatively simple issue. I believe perhaps more simple than what our briefs, as brief as they are, has portrayed it, because in addition to the 12th district, Your Honor, what you actually have is you have the 6th and the 8th and the 11th and the 10th districts all doing it the same way. And the reason I think that they're doing it that way is in combination between this court's case, Marker versus Graham, and the statutory directive. That case and the statute stand for about three very important propositions. One, the guidelines are mandatory. As you are all aware, there's a chart that says this is the presumed amount of correct money that's necessary to raise a child when two parties have a certain amount of income. And you put the party's income into this calculation sheet, it comes out with a joint obligation. The second thing is that obligation is presumed to be correct. And certainly the statute does direct, it does give us some guidance, that you don't deviate from that amount unless it's in the best interest of the child. Now here's where the confusion a lot of times comes in, Your Honor, and Justice Stratton brought this up, in regard to if you do it the way we propose, does the child actually receive less money? And I think the difference is in what you consider to be the receipt of money and the obligation. For example, you calculate the child support obligation versus the guidelines and you get a joint obligation. At that point in time, there is no line item in the statute or in the calculation sheet for what you do with Social Security received by the child. So what do you do with it? You have a joint obligation. Now, as I indicated, the 6th and the 8th and the 10th and the 11th and the 12th districts say when it's the child receiving the money, and as far as this kind of Social Security is concerned, that does not affect the money the father receives, the disabled parent. Does not reduce his income one dime from what the child gets. But what all these other court of appeals are doing is you take that Social Security out of the joint obligation. And then what you have left, you distribute between both parents according to a percentage.
Counsel, what if, take the example, say there's a dissolution agreement that makes both parents responsible for the higher education of the child, so age 21 to equally responsible. And one parent goes out and buys a prepaid tuition. That's in the child's name, so the benefit goes directly to the child. There, you would, I assume, say that parent that coughed up the dough for that benefit, even though the benefit comes directly to the child or is owned by the child, the title of the child, credit to the parent who's so provided. Would that not seem fair, or would that?
Two reasons why I think it would. One, the statute gives the college discretion to deviate from the guidelines for a number of factors. One of the factors is other financial obligations that have been incurred for the benefit of the child. I think the court would have the discretion that he can deviate from the guidelines in that case. One of the reported cases that we both cited is this pre-bite case. I'm sorry, the pre-bite case, for what that's exactly what was going on. The residential parent was taking the child support, the Social Security money, and putting it aside in a tuition fund. And the court then, one of the courts that we've cited, which distinguishes that case for that reason, says, well, she wasn't using that money for support, so it's really a different factor. But in that case, yes, the legislators have discretion to make a deviation based upon that. But in the standard cases, as I think raises addresses Judge Stratton's question, is if you look at the joint obligation, what the 12th district and the other districts did in this case, the obligation is higher because you have a joint obligation. You take the Social Security money off of the father's only, the non-residential parent, and so the obligation is the guidelines amount
plus the Social Security. So it looks like it's more money. But in reality, the residential parent receives less money. And this is what I think Justin Warner was referring to. Because in reality, the cost to raise a child don't change. That house payment and that car payment and the insurance and the food and clothing and shelter for that child do not change, regardless of the amount of Social Security. What changes is the amount of money that is received by the residential parent to support that child. The Social Security money is received, and if you adopt the position that the appellant in this case takes, that's all they receive, and that's less than the presumed guideline amount. If you take it the way the 6th and the 8th and the 10th and the 11th and the 12th districts have done it, the child receives the Social Security amount plus the amount necessary to show that the guidelines amount is received. In this case, $50 a month.
But the flip side of it is that your client, who's able-bodied and able to earn an income, pays less because of the disability.
Does not pay less because her share of the joint obligation is less, if you look at it that way. Her groceries are not less. Her expenses are not less. Her house payments are not less. The clothes are not less. The residential parent takes care of this child and provides everything this child needs, regardless of how much Social Security money she has, and regardless of how much
what would happen if the disabled father had nothing to do?
Your Honor, and this is the point I wanted to bring up, almost every case that the appellant cites to support this position deviates from the facts in this case for just those exact reasons. In the Edmonds case and in the Stevenson's case, it is the disabled parent that is the obligee. Has custody of the child in both of those cases. And in that case, what the courts have done, and that's why I think it's different than this case, they take the Social Security income of the child and they throw it in with the gross income of the custodial parent, which raises the guideline amount. And then you get a higher joint obligation. Then they credit that amount against the parent, the residential parent, the disabled parent, share the joint obligation solely and exclusively and distribute whatever's left over. But usually they're not going to keep anything left over under the circumstances. That's Edmonds and that's Stevenson, which he cited as authority, which are completely different. And Johnson.
If the disabled parent has custody of the kid, of course they're giving the disabled parent full credit.
Yes, sir. Exactly right. Because they're not only the ones who are disabled and causing the money to be paid, but they're the ones actually getting the money at the same time. And I can't quarrel with that.
Otherwise.
Because they're the ones who are disabled, they're the ones who are getting not only their own disability payments, but also the child's disability payments. And it happens in Stevenson, that's appropriate. They've got custody. In the other case that he cited from the second district, which is the Johnson case, it's a split custody case. And you have to look at the facts carefully. Both parents have a child. One of the parents is disabled, and again, what the second district did in that case is take the Social Security money, included the gross income of the disabled parent, and then when you get a support obligation for the child with the mother, you take the Social Security that that child receives from the parent, because both children are getting Social Security separately, and crediting against the disabled parent's child support obligation, but it's a split custody situation. In the Mudrack case from the seventh district, which cites, the grandparents have custody, neither parent do. And in that case, again, it's a situation where, yeah, they're taking the Social Security money and they're adding it into the obligor's income first, then getting the child support joint obligation first into the statute, and then you see what the non-residential parent, the father, the disabled parent's support obligation is, and credited against that. So in every one of those cases that is cited by the appellant, it's a completely factual, dissimilar situation. Every court that I have been able to find, except the Pry versus Nolan case, which is from 1987, 1 year after the guidelines were passed, and about 5 years before your decision in the Marker versus Grimm case, that's the only one that's different. But in all the cases that the appellant cites, it's a different factual situation because it's not the disabled parent, it's the non-residential parent who is not disabled receiving the money.
Well, we did the Marker versus Grimm case, and you remember from reading it, I was actively involved in that. I went through that whole worksheet, line by line, and filled one out. And I thought Marker probably answered this with regard to the income issue. Didn't we include whatever the income of the individual spouse was to reach the bottom line to which the percentage applied?
Yes.
Okay. This income is not being received. by the husband, either parent in this case, but the husband in this case.
You're correct.
Okay. So it's independent income, and there isn't even a line on that worksheet, as I remember, for this kind of a proposition.
Correct.
All right. So your contention would be you apply this independent income to the total balance, reduce the amount by whatever the child support is, reduce it by that amount, and percentage-wise split it between the two parties.
Yes. Exactly what the 6th and the 8th and 10th and the 11th and the 12th districts all do in that situation. And the reason why that's true, you look at a procedural, you've got a statute that tells you what to do. Now, the statute doesn't say where you put the child, the independent income, in the calculation first, but it does as a factor to consider income and financial resources of the child. The child gets
income. Whether the check comes directly from the government or not, is the purpose of Social Security income payments to the child to replace what the disabled spouse is able to pay? Is that the purpose of Social Security?
I think it's to replace the support. I don't agree with that. This is why. I think it's to replace the amount of support the father, the non-resident, or the disabled parent may be able to pay if they were able to work and make more money. And it's a little different. Because the $167 a month in Social Security is not intended to represent the support that that parent can pay. It's intended to represent if the father were able to go out and make a living, he would be able to afford to pay more child support than simply perhaps the Social Security amount. So how do you look at that?
Because you get more income.
What you're making them do is now pay extra out of their Social Security for a payment the government has already said is going to replace that for the child.
Yes, and I don't apologize for that, Your Honor. The overriding standard in a child support case is the best interest of the child. The legislature has said not deviate from that guideline amount unless it's in the best interest of the child. And I continue to question, when is it ever going to be in the best interest of the child that the child will receive less money to take care of that child? And it's $50 a month what we're talking about, is all of the disabled father's obligation is to pay the support.
Does the court have the ability to look at the needs of a parent to survive? Is that an important factor that you have to do?
I believe, Your Honor, that's one of the deviation factors for a court to consider in their discretion. Is the other obligations of the parents and things like that, but
how much did this
father receive? I think he paid $607 a month or something like that. The problem we get into with looking at that is that because the guidelines specifically say how you calculate their gross income, it kind of says you take into consideration already they don't have much income.
607. 605
a month.
I'm not sure the number, but it's
something like that. The government is giving a check that represents disability support to kids, directed to the kid, and you want to say that doesn't count on his team, and you guys can have him pay another 50, and he's supposed to live on 550 a month?
I'm saying that because I think what Marbury versus Grimm says, that the overriding principle says, I think that's what the legislature has said. And I think because the legislature changed that, I don't like that result. Now, for some reason, legislature said that. I think the reason for that is because the guidelines already take into consideration a parent with low income is going to pay less support. And then you say, okay, there's this $167 coming in from Social Security. Does that mean the parent should have an independent obligation out of their own pocket to pay support? We have parents all the time who refuse to work, who are on unemployment compensation, who are on workers' compensation, who are on all other kinds of income that are not full gainful wages, and they're made to pay support the same way. And it's unfortunate, but if he could work, Your Honor, if he could work, he would be paying a whole lot more.
Well, but don't we assume that the government agency that decides how much the daughter is going to receive and how much he's going to receive has made a determination of how much she, that there's a balancing here. If we're going to give this much to the daughter, which would go to the father, probably, if it wasn't a daughter. Would the amount that the daughter is receiving, or the minor daughter is receiving, go to the father if there was not a daughter?
Absolutely not. And I think that's a large portion for the confusion, that it affects in not one way the disability payment the father's entitled to receive. Not one way. And I think I'm not claiming to be an expert in Social Security law, Your Honor, but I do understand that this has never raised the case that his income, his Social Security payment would have been more had it not been for the fact that there's a dependent. Now, that may be true with the other kind of Social Security, but not SSI, but not Social Security disability.
You know, there's another argument here that bothers me, or another fact that bothers me that we haven't discussed, and I guess you all didn't discuss it very much either, but this concept that he's receiving what he gets for Social Security disability and what the daughter gets, that he himself accumulated that without the assistance of a spouse, is ridiculous, to me anyway. It's a point partnership during that period of time. And she ought to have some credit for, in addition to how we're doing it here or how it was done here, she ought to have some credit for having supported that whole situation while he was earning it.
You are absolutely right, Mark. You may be aware of Social Security law provides that if you're married for more than 10 years, your own retirement benefit is determined at least in part by the accumulation your spouse has had. And in this case, I think the overriding consideration is this. The statute says the guidelines is presumed to be the correct amount of money necessary to raise a child when one party is only income of $607 a month, another party is out working for a living and making $20,000 a year. No large sum in and of itself.
Do you do a substantial amount of this kind of work, domestic work? It was my impression, at least from our motions for cert, that Marker versus Grimm has been working in the marketplace. Has it?
I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer your question, or I absolutely think it is. If you remember that all these old cases that I think that the appellant relies upon all talk about what's fair to the father and what's easier on the father, I apologize, on the non-residential parent, on the disabled parent, what's fair for them. I don't think that matters a whole lot. What's fair for the child is what matters, and that $50 a month will help pay for books and groceries and uninsured medical expenses and other things that the child's not receiving simply because the father cannot go out.
Well, my point was that in our weekly motions for cert, we were seeing a number of cases, sometimes usually every week, on these types of issues. And since Marker versus Grimm, we've had none, I think. Maybe one.
Thank you, Mr. Eagle. Mr. McGee, you save 5 minutes of your time.
I believe that Justice Stratton's understanding this is really about unjust and inappropriate, which is under the statute. It does allow the court to address that. This particular trial judge, indicated that this was an unjust and inappropriate result based on the he wrote an opinion on this, and he put it down and he asked that the court change what was law in the 12th district. One thing to keep in mind is there's the Budrag, Stevenson, Edmonds decision that I believe are very, very correct to this, and it says the fair result is that a parent's disability be credited towards that parent's obligation. Okay? The amount of payment that's coming in because of that parent's disability and because of that parent's work should, in fact, be credited against that parent's obligation. It's throughout a number of the cases that have been written. One of the cases that I cite comes out of the Supreme Court of Alaska, which goes through this particular thing, the Miller case. I believe that you must have talk about best interest of the child. It's best interest of the child that when that parent's with that child, that parent has some ability to do something with that child.
But doesn't that argument ignore that the Social Security disability or the Social Security benefits being received by the child was a product of a joint enterprise, not just his?
Honor,
I mean, she was home taking care of the child, maybe.
No, it was not a product of the joint enterprise, okay?
Why not? They were married.
That particular amount that's being paid for that particular child is only based upon that disabled parent's earnings.
Yeah, but could he have gone out and earned it if he had been taking care of the child? That's the point. They each had various responsibilities.
He's been living separately. I believe this case dates back over 10 years as to the amount of time that these parents have been separated.
What difference does that make? It's still a partnership during the coverture,
isn't it?
It's
a partnership within reason. But the fact of the matter is, it's sort of an insurance that is being bought by everybody that paid into the system. And it is no different than any other insurance benefit.
Should we decide this case as a matter of law or as abuse of discretion? Should we decide this case based upon a rule of law or as a matter of abuse of discretion? In other words, should the trial court be given discretion to decide case by case how we calculate the amount that comes from Social Security to a child, or should we say as a matter of law that it always goes one way or the other?
I believe it should be a matter of law as that it goes to the person who made it possible. I think that's the only way that the courts are going to be able to deal with it. That the person who has the child is disabled, the other party should not get any credit for that. It should go into the income calculation, but the other party should not get any credit for that. When we talk about workers' compensation, unemployment, all those things, we don't have a separate amount dictated to go to the child. This is, through the cases that are cited there, this amount that's going to the child is a substitute for this man's support of that child, and that's what it's all about. That's why that amount comes down from the government. There's a number of quotations, there's a number of citations as to various authorities to that effect, but this is certainly a much fairer way of doing it, I think a more appropriate way, and I think it made for a lot less confusion across the state if that was the back of the wall.
I understand your captain, let me put it in real numbers. Assume this would pay our client $600 a month. You're saying that your client should get $600 a month as income plus the $167 as income. If he gets charged as income, the amount, if he gets credit,
right, I'm saying that you'd be charged for the amount the child's receiving, the amount that he's receiving, that would be his income.
And right now, he's not charged his income.
No, he gets his amount, and then she gets whatever she receives, and then eventually it comes off the joint obligation.
So he could still end up paying something under the calculation?
Probably not. For the most part, the amount that's paid on Social Security is usually far greater than the amount that's that the calculation is under most circumstances, because those figures are always made up as a substitute for this man's support. As I understand the guidelines, they came from sort of a global model as to what it takes to support a child.
So we would assume he would make $20,000 or $25,000 for the Social Security figure that they think the father might make to make a change.
Right. That would have been what they figure is obligation to be. As a matter of practicality, is always greater than what the child support guidelines are. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.